Chapter 119. I myself, I say, gentlemen, humble as I am, have been found not unworthy to share Mr. Osborne's elegant hospitality. And though I have feasted with the great and noble of the world, for I presume that I may call my excellent friend and patron, the Right Honorable George Earl of Barristers, one of the number, yet I assure you that the board of the British Merchant was to the full as richly served, and his reception as gratifying and noble. Mr. Bluck, sir, we will resume, if you please, that passage of Eutropus, which was interrupted by the late arrival of Master Osborne. To this great man George's education was for some time entrusted. Amelia was bewildered by his phrases, but thought him a prodigy of learning. That poor widow made friends of Mrs. Veal, for reasons of her own. She liked to be in the house, and see Georgie coming to school there. She liked to be asked to Mrs. Veal's conversazione, which took place once a month, as you were informed, on pink cards, with AOHNH engraved on them, and where the professor welcomed his pupils and their friends to weak tea and scientific conversation. Poor little Amelia never missed one of these entertainments, and thought them delicious so long as she might have Georgie sitting by her. And she would walk from Brompton in any weather, and embrace Mrs. Veal with tearful gratitude for the delightful evening as he had passed, when, the company having retired and Georgie gone off with Mr. Rosen, his attendant, poor Mrs. Osborne put on her cloaks and her shawls preparatory to walking home. As for the learning which Georgie imbibed under this valuable master of 100 sciences, to judge from the weekly reports which the lad took home to his grandfather, his progress was remarkable. The names of a score or more of desirable branches of knowledge were printed in a table, and the pupil's progress in each was marked by the professor. In Greek Georgie was pronounced Aristos, in Latin Optimus, in French Trespine, and so forth. And everybody had prizes for everything at the end of the year. Even Mr. Swartz, the woolly-headed young gentleman, and half-brother to the Honorable Mrs. MacMull, and Mr. Bluck, the neglected young pupil of 23 from the agricultural district, and that idle young scapegrace of a Master Todd before mentioned, received little 18-penny books, with theme engraved on them, and a pompous Latin inscription from the professor to his young friends. The family of this Master Todd were hangers-on of the house of Osborne. The old gentleman had advanced Todd from being a clerk to be a junior partner in his establishment. Mr. Osborne was the godfather of young Master Todd, who in subsequent life wrote Mr. Osborne Todd on his cards, and became a man of decided fashion, while Miss Osborne had accompanied Miss Maria Todd to the font, and gave her protege a prayer book, a collection of tracts, a volume of very low church poetry, or some such memento of her goodness every year. Miss O drove the Todds out in her carriage now and then. When they were ill, her footman, in large plush smalls and waistcoat, brought jellies and delicacies from Russell Square to Coram Street. Coram Street trembled and looked up to Russell Square indeed, and Mrs. Todd, who had a pretty hand at cutting out paper trimmings for haunches of mutton, and could make flowers, ducks, and sea, out of turnips and carrots in a very creditable manner, would go to the square, as it was called, and assist in the preparations incident to a great dinner, without even so much as thinking of sitting down to the banquet. If any guest failed at the 11th hour, Todd was asked to dine. Mrs. Todd and Maria came across in the evening, slipped in with a muffled knock, and were in the drawing room by the time Miss Osborne and the ladies under her convoy reached that apartment, and ready to fire off duets and sing until the gentlemen came up. Poor Maria Todd! Poor young lady! How as he had to work and thrum at these duets and sonatas in the street before they appeared in public in the square. Thus it seemed to be decreed by fate that Georgie was to domineer over everybody with whom he came in contact, and that friends, relatives, and domestics were all to bow the knee before the little fellow. It must be owned that he accommodated himself very willingly to this arrangement. Most people do so. and Georgi liked to play the part of master, and perhaps had a natural aptitude for it. In Russell Square everybody was afraid of Mr. Osborne, and Mr. Osborne was afraid of Georgi. The boy's dashing manners, and offhand rattle about books and learning, his likeness to his father dead unreconciled in Brussels yonder, awed the old gentleman, and gave the young boy the mastery. The old man would start at some hereditary feature or tone unconsciously used by the little lad, and fancy that George's father was again before him. He tried by indulgence to the grandson, to make up for harshness to the elder George. People were surprised at his gentleness to the boy. He growled and swore at Miss Osborne as usual, and would smile when George came down late for breakfast. Miss Osborne, George's aunt, was a faded old spinster, broken down by more than 40 years of dullness and coarse usage. It was easy for a lad of spirit to master her. And whenever George wanted anything from her, from the jam pots in her cupboards to the cracked and dry old colors in her paint box, the old paint box which she had had when she was a pupil of Mr. Smee, and was still almost young and blooming, Georgi took possession of the object of his desire, which obtained, he took no further notice of his aunt. For his friends and cronies, he had a pompous old schoolmaster, who flattered him, and a toady, his senior, whom he could thrash. It was dear Mrs. Todd's delight to leave him with her youngest daughter, Rosa Jemima, a darling child of 8 years old. The little pair looked so well together, she would say, but not to the folks in the square, we may be sure, who knows what might happen? Don't they make a pretty little couple, the fond mother thought. The broken-spirited, old, maternal grandfather was likewise subject to the little tyrant. He could not help respecting a lad who had such fine clothes, and rode with a groom behind him. Georgi, on his side, was in the constant habit of hearing coarse abuse and vulgar satire leveled at John Sedley by his pitiless old enemy, Mr. Osborne. Osborne used to call the other the old pauper, the old coal man, the old bankrupt, and by many other such names of brutal contumely. How was little George to respect a man so prostrate? A few months after he was with his paternal grandfather, Mrs. Sedley died. There had been little love between her and the child. He did not care to show much grief. He came down to visit his mother in a fine new suit of mourning, and was very angry that he could not go to a play upon which he had set his heart. The illness of that old lady had been the occupation and perhaps the safeguard of Amelia. What do men know about women's martyrdoms? We should go mad had we to endure the hundredth part of those daily pains which are meekly borne by many women. Ceaseless slavery meeting with no reward. Constant gentleness and kindness met by cruelty as constant. Love, labor, patience, watchfulness, without even so much as the acknowledgement of a good word. All this, how many of them have to bear in quiet, and appear abroad with cheerful faces, as if they felt nothing. Tender slaves that they are, they must needs be hypocrites and weak. From her chair Amelia's mother had taken to her bed, which as he had never left, and from which Mrs. Osborne herself was never absent except when she ran to see George. The old lady grudged her even those rare visits. She, who had been a kind, smiling, good-natured mother once, in the days of her prosperity, but whom poverty and infirmities had broken down. Her illness or estrangement did not affect Amelia. They rather enabled her to support the other calamity under which she was suffering, and from the thoughts of which she was kept by the ceaseless calls of the invalid. Amelia bore her harshness quite gently, smoothed the uneasy pillow, was always ready with a soft answer to the watchful, querulous voice, soothed the sufferer with words of hope, such as her pious simple heart could best feel and utter, and closed the eyes that had once looked so tenderly upon her. Then all her time and tenderness were devoted to the consolation and comfort of the bereaved old father, who was stunned by the blow which had befallen him, and stood utterly alone in the world. His wife, his honor, his fortune, everything he loved best had fallen away from him. There was only Amelia, to stand by and support with her gentle arms the tottering, heartbroken old man. We are not going to write the history. It would be too dreary and stupid. I can see Vanity Fair yawning over at Davin's. One day as the young gentlemen were assembled in the study at the Rev. Mr. Veals, and the domestic chaplain to the Right Honorable Earlove Barrisers was spouting away as usual, a smart carriage drove up to the door decorated with the statue of Athene, and two gentlemen stepped out. The young master's bangles rushed to the window with a vague notion that their father might have arrived from Bombay. The great hulking scholar of 23, who was crying secretly over a passage of Eutropius, flattened his neglected nose against the panes and looked at the drag, as the lackwaste of place sprang from the box and let out the persons in the carriage. "It's a fat one and a thin one," Mr. Bluck said as a thundering knock came to the door. Everybody was interested, from the domestic chaplain himself, who hoped he saw the fathers of some future pupils, down to Master Georgie, glad of any pretext for laying his book down. The boy in the shabby livery with the faded copper buttons, who always thrust himself into the tight coat to open the door, came into the study and said, "Two gentlemen want to see Master Osborne." The professor had had a trifling altercation in the morning with that young gentleman, owing to a difference about the introduction of crackers in school time, but his face resumed its habitual expression of bland courtesy as he said, "Master Osborne, I give you full permission to go and see your carriage friends, to whom I beg you to convey the respectful compliments of myself and Mrs. Veal." Georgie went into the reception room and saw two strangers, whom he looked at with his head up, in his usual haughty manner. One was fat, with mustachios, and the other was lean and long, in a blue frock coat, with a brown face and a grizzled head. "My God, how like he is," said the long gentleman with a start. "Can you guess who we are, George?" The boy's face flushed up, as it did usually when he was moved, and his eyes brightened. "Don't know the other," he said, "but I should think you must be Major Dobbin." Indeed, it was our old friend. His voice trembled with pleasure as he greeted the boy, and taking both the other's hands in his own, drew the lad to him. "Your mother has talked to you about me, has she?" he said. "That is, he has," Georgie answered, "hundreds and hundreds of times." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.